The dean of the Washington Cathedral, Dr. Sayre, anguished in public some Sundays ago. He was unhappy with both of the candidates for the presidency, with the electorate, indeed with the entire context of our national life. The dean's plight put me in mind of a delightful quatrain of Ogden Nash's. They are of such refined and delicate palates, they can find no one worthy of their ballots. And then when someone terrible is elected, they say there, that's what I always expected. Now I began my comments to you on the election of 1964 with that exact paragraph. And men and children are today still anguishing to vote or not to vote. Remember the bumper stickers of 4 years ago, vote no for president? It seems to me that Mort Saul was the Pap Paulson of the day, the anti-candidate of the snide set. Could make an observation about the astuteness of Kohelet, who, as you know, observed some 2,000 years ago, that which has been is that which shall be. But I limit myself to saying that I had very few kind words for the political dropouts 4 years ago. I don't like children, childish men, who insist that if you won't play my way with my ball and my bat and my being captain, then I won't play. And I have, if anything, less sympathy for that position now. A political election in the United States is not simply a beauty contest between two candidates. It's a party contest. We choose a party administration. Each candidate is a party nominee. He runs on a party platform. And by the nature of things, in a country of 200 million of people, parties are vast conglomerates, groups and peoples, and no one person and not even any one group, however sizable within a party, can expect its platform and its personality to reflect exactly its preference and its priority. Now I know that there's some young, pristine political theorists who would have us change the system. If each party can't speak with a single voice in a single way, then let's have a lot of parties, 3 or 4 or 10. Well, God love little Israel. She's the very, very model of a participatory democracy. Every minion has its own political party. And yet in the 20 years of the state's existence, only one party has ruled and governed. Israel today is still being governed by the same old men. The political system is a very delicate and intricate mechanism. And I'm troubled by those who say so glibly to us, tinker with it, change it a bit. There are ways of getting more freedom into the system, more air and more light. Yes, and there are also ways when you tinker with a political system of getting less freedom into it and limiting your choice. Frankly, if the exhibit of the untrammeled freedom given to us in Chicago 10 months ago by the New Politics Convention is any example of what the new left means by freedom, I don't want any part of it. Because the electors at that convention were not only managed by a number of political forces and by party mechanisms, but they had to agree, hardly before the convention opened, that they would accept the platform and the candidates as they were brought out of a black party caucus which had yet to meet and make its decisions. If that be freedom, I don't understand the meaning of the word. You know, as a religionist, I know a certain cast of mind. We call it apocalyptic. The man who has apocalyptic mind is so close to the future, it's so real to him that he can taste it and smell it, it's palpable, he can touch it, and he lives in it. And so in the first century, he left his wife, he left his children to be somebody else's responsibility. He left his business, he left his country to be defended by somebody else, and he went out into the wilderness to prepare his soul for the coming of the kingdom. Now today, our apocalyptics don't go into the desert. They go into the wastelands of our city, into the coffee houses. But the result's the same. Someone else, probably their parents, must earn their living. Someone else, probably a buddy, must defend their freedoms. Someone else, you and I, must maintain the political system which gives them the right to dissent and to desert. By the very nature of things, this world is imperfect. The Greeks were quite right when they described the kingdom as utopia, utopos, nowhere. It's the dream which keeps us going. It's the place we'll never get to. And I think that, I hope, that many of our young people, the apocalyptics of the day, who live in the hovels of today but surrounded by the glories of tomorrow, will learn to live with the glories of today and destroy the hovels of today and help us move this great society a little bit towards a better tomorrow. And I confess also, when I consider those who will not vote, feel above it, the political dropouts, that I occasionally at night have a nightmare. I'm in a ballpark. And one young team doesn't like the way the grass is cut. And they're following their coach, his name is McCarthy, out of the ballpark to some other field. And as they're leaving the ballpark, there's another team descending from a bus. Their spikes are sharpened. Their coach has run on ahead, and he's already upbraiding the man in black, the umpire, the judge. He's already telling him, "We play now by my rules. The rules of the game are thrown out." And that man's name is George Wallace. And his team is called the White Lice. I warn you also that not only is there no black athlete on that team, but there's no Jewish name in the lineup. I'm a little troubled by some of the sense of urgency I feel in this nation, some of the sense of frustration that the two parties didn't give us new faces, a Sir Galahad, someone who would wave a magic wand, and the glorious future would suddenly be here. You can lay a lot of complaints against both parties, the apparatchiks, the party professionals, went with the old political loyalists. They didn't respond to a very basic surge of interest in the nation for a new spirit, a younger person, fresher ideas. But you know, in a strange way, I think this is a blessing in disguise. Because ultimately, a democracy cannot depend upon a savior. Saviors always somehow become dictators, demagogues. Democracy must depend upon its people. And if we are concerned with poverty and with race and with blight and with alienation and with crime and with violence, there's nothing one man in the White House can do, however vigorous, however energetic, however youthful, however charismatic, unless we're about to join with him in that crusade. He can't get a war on poverty funded through Congress unless we want it, and he can't get it effected in the communities unless we join that militia. Frankly, I see very little indication in the electorate this year of a willingness to join in citizenship, an energetic, vigorous concern with blotting out the social evils. We want somebody, some savior, to do it for us. In this sense, Mr. Nixon is not the one, and Mr. Humphrey is not the one. The only one is you and I. We are the only ones who can make this country go forward. We are the only ones who can sculpt a decent tomorrow. And if we're as selfish as we seem to be, and as short-sighted, and as prejudiced, and as peevish, and as petulant as this electorate this year seems to be, no man on a white horse will lead us, except where he wants to lead us. The glory that we dream of is action, false. This country, instead of taking advantage of the fantastic abundance, the fantastic opportunity which is ours, will destroy that opportunity, pull itself apart, it seems. Now, if Mr. Nixon is not the one and Mr. Humphrey is not the one, neither are they the Tweedledum and Tweedledee mediocrities that some of their snide denigrators would have them claim them to be. Both men are responsible men. Both men have had fine and distinguished public careers. Both men have given great service to their nation. After an unfortunate and brash start in California politics, Mr. Nixon has served in many of the important roles and posts in our land. And probably more than anyone else, he is responsible for the renewal of the Republican Party after the shambles of 1964. And if this is a partisan achievement, and it is, of course, it is also an important achievement for all of us, because a two-party system requires two strong parties. And Mr. Humphrey has a record of lifelong dedication to civil rights and social legislation. He's the author of the Medicare program. As a senator, he was involved in most of the significant social legislation of his period, and as a vice president, he has helped to write and push through the Congress some of the most important of the new programs of the Fair Deal. Both men easily outdistance in their record of public service and the quality of their person most of the men who are so quick to denigrate, to call them mediocrities and worse. Both men would rank well up on a comparative listing of all of the candidates for the presidency of the United States who have been placed before the electorate. Now, both of them, of course, have faults. As someone observed, Mr. Humphrey doesn't know yet that a speech to be immortal doesn't have to be eternal. And Mr. Nixon is not yet, in some ways, clear where public relations ends and public responsibility begins. And there are other faults, obviously. They're human. But let him who is faultless throw the first stone. Indeed, when I take the measure of the candidates this year, I confess I am more disturbed by the measure of the electorate than I am by the measure of the candidates. If we look at ourselves in the mirror, we don't present in this election year of 1968 a very pretty sight. There's a new left, and there's a new right. You can take your pick. Both of them remind me of children who are trying to kick down the tinker toy construction so that they can play God and build it up again, you know, their own way to suit their own taste. When the new right doesn't like a decision of the courts of the land, it stands in the schoolhouse door in open defiance of the majesty of the law. When the new right left doesn't like the way an establishment is operated, it sits down in the schoolhouse doors and defies the rules of the land. And when both of them are picked up and summarily ejected, so that students come in and can study, and so the teachers can come in and can teach, both of them cry, "Foul! I'm above the law. You can't touch me." Both these groups are fundamentally anarchistic and undemocratic. Both of them have only contempt for due process. Neither of them assumes the law is inviolate. One happily and disingenuously proclaims itself anarchistic, the new left, and the new right uses the technique of the big lie. Imagine a man who leads this party who has only one credential for fame, that for 10 years he has been in open defiance of the law. Imagine such a man making the motto of his campaign, "Law and Order." But what disturbs me even more than these ideologues of the left and the right, because one can make a case that we've always had these extreme fringes in American politics, and always probably will, is the willingness of so many in the so-called moderate center to join with them. The fat-bellied middle class, so many of them showing their racist prejudice, joining Mr. Wallace. The lean-bellied college class, so many of them showing their prejudices, joining the Mark Rudds, the Tom Haydens, and the like. I've had occasion these last few weeks to speak to a number of the candidates for office in our state, for Senate, for the House, and all of them from both parties say, "You know, you can't talk issues this election. You can't be reasonable with people. All they want are slogans. They want to shout or to shout against. They want to shout hurrah without listening with what you're saying, or to shout down with the bum without listening to what you're saying." And it's true, isn't it? What's come through the mass media, the newspapers, the candidate speeches, or the hectoring, the heckling, the demonstration, the protesting, the professional group of applauders in the front row, the professional group of shouters in the back row? It's been a campaign in which it's been very difficult for any of us to sort out issues, even to hear the issues, in part because so many no longer want to hear them. Imagine that a significant number of the working class, we are told, will vote for a man whose record in office stands antithetical to everything that the laboring class needs. Unionizations, the strength of unions, a tax rate which will attack wealth more than attack one's wages and one's modest earnings. Imagine an intellectual class who will sit out an election in the name of freedom, and at the very time be undercutting and destroying the very freedom they claim to be championing. And yet that's the way it is in 1968. Try to understand why. In part, the situation exists, I believe, because this campaign was over 5 months ago. A political campaign in the United States in our two-party system is essentially a campaign between an administration which must run on its record and the other party, the out party, which challenges that record and says to it, "You didn't do enough, or you began to lead us down the wrong road. We want to get back to this way, this highway, and go down it." Now, the polls and Senator McCarthy's victory in New Hampshire led the President of the United States to give his concession speech on the last Sunday in March. From then on, there was no record over which this election could be fought. Mr. Johnson saved his ego from a bad bruising. I think he was somewhat concerned with entering the history books with what dignity he could muster. Whatever his reasons, by doing his thing, by withdrawing from the campaign, he did the nation a disservice. Because doing one's thing, walking one's lonely way, always does a nation a disservice. This is a social grouping. And we needed a record against which to judge the party and the claims that the party were making. And all we've had ever since is a mad scramble by office seekers seeking their political advantage. It's been an ice cream and lollipop campaign. To every group, those things which the group most wants. Mr. Thurman got his vice presidential campaign. God save us if Mr. Nixon wins his strength. May he live long. Mr. Daley got his convention in Chicago. God save us for any more such displays of national conventions. Every group got what its most narrow, immediate want seemed to be. Candidates ceased to speak to the issues and spoke only of the glories of tomorrow, the promises of today. And the issue became very, very clouded, and I think most of us got the sense that we were being manipulated. This campaign was being shot down, to use a phrase which was popular several years ago, at a credibility gap. No one was speaking honestly to us. And I suspect that's one of the reasons that the two vice presidential candidates have made such an eclat, have become so important in this campaign. Mr. Agnew may have the foot and mouth disease, but he's at least a human being, he's genuine. And Mr. Muskie has spoken with a moderate common sense and a balance and an openness I think most of us of both parties, of all parties, and no party, have appreciated. Indeed, this is the first time, I think, in all history where a massive public relations campaign has been mounted by one of the parties, hoping that the presidential candidate could ride in on the vice presidential candidate's coattails. Mr. Humphrey, in his unwillingness to enter the primaries before Chicago, and Mr. Nixon, in his aloofness, his mantle of being above the issues since Miami, since his convention, has disturbed all of us. Because we need a quadrennial election campaign in order to re-inform ourselves as to the problems of the nation, in order to reacquaint ourselves with the political options open to us for the solving of the very many and very real problems which confront this nation. And this campaign has not given us that opportunity. No one has spoken emiss. Simple, unvarnished truth, common sense to us. Unfortunately, Mr. Humphrey, at least in these last several weeks, has seemed to shake himself loose of the leash which bound him to the White House, and he's begun to speak to the issues. And he alone among the candidates so far has been unwilling to paint, you know, a glorious, all-brilliant picture of the future. Wherefore, less taxes and less public service and less sacrifice, you're going to have the greater tomorrow. Mr. Nixon's domestic policies confuse me, frankly. I fail to understand how cutting the federal budget and cutting taxes and cutting some of the welfare programs and turning them over to the private sector and solving all the social problems by finding more jobs for the unemployed is going to solve the problems of the city. There's been a number of national studies, and it's been shown that on the rolls of public assistance, only 3 in 100 are able-bodied men who could be put to work gainfully in our economy. The rest are mothers and children and the aged and the institutionalized and the blind and the infirm and the crippled. And they're going to remain on the public assistance rolls, whatever happens, however many jobs are available. And the cost of maintaining them and of rehabilitating them is going to rise, not fall. And if we are all serious about wanting to do something about the blight of our cities, about the pollution of our air and of our water, about the need to rehabilitate those who have been inadequately educated in our school systems, this is going to cost hundreds of millions and even billions upon billions of dollars. And you can't hold out the carrot at the end of the stick to the American people and not be honest enough to tell them there's a bill. Anybody who says America can solve his problems speaks the truth. But anybody who says America can solve its problems at little cost or at no cost with the same level of individual luxury and abundance that so many of our stuffed citizens have enjoyed lies. And even as this be the purple of campaign rhetoric, he misguides. We know our problems. We see them etched daily in the headlines. We hear the noise of the sirens in our streets. All of us want to solve these problems. For God's sakes, let's tell our leaders to cease painting a rosy picture which doesn't include sacrifice and giving of self and higher taxes and less special privilege. I'm tired of hearing so many say, they want too much too fast. Always they. They want too much too fast. All I want is lower taxes and a higher paycheck and the privilege of saying who can live on my street and the best education for my child and security for my family. That's all I want. But they want too much too fast. And I'm tired of paying the taxes for it. I don't know if Mr. Nixon will manage to throw away the tremendous advantage with which he entered this campaign. But if he does, it'll be for one reason only. The American people do not want a leader of Olympian aloofness. They want somebody who will talk common sense. The young person's phrase, tell it as it is. Not give us the platitudes. I've long since come to feel the basic judgment that must be made in a presidential campaign is a judgment on the conduct of foreign policy. On the domestic scene, a president can suggest and he can clarify issues, but ultimately there's always the check or the encouragement of Congress. Congress really makes the social policy of the nation, but not so in foreign policy. These are administrative decisions. Mr. Truman's decision was to enter and involve ourselves in Korea. Mr. Kennedy's decision was to involve ourselves in the Bay of Pigs. Mr. Johnson's decision was to escalate the war in Vietnam. Now, the Congress may carp and cavil after the fact, and it may complain that it was not consulted. But ultimately, the kind of deliberation that social legislation receives cannot be given in the foreign policy field. This is the prerogative and the responsibility of the presidency. The thing that has disturbed me most about this campaign is that the foreign political issues have not been discussed by either candidate. I do not know where either of them stands on the basic issues which confront this nation as a world power. Oh yes, there's been a lot of talk about negotiations in Paris, but the decision to negotiate was made in March of 1968. It's not the decision of November 1968. The polls in New Hampshire said the American people want out. And you can't debate the pace of a negotiation. That's not a public issue. The issue before the American people is how to present another Vietnam. What are the limitations of American power? I haven't heard either candidate discuss whether or not the domino theory or the concept of building bases around the fringe of China and the mainland of Asia, or bases generally around the fringes of the communist world, is in fact a viable policy in 1968. Obviously, 1968 is a different year in international affairs. After the Middle East crisis, after Czechoslovakia, after the revolutions in Latin America and in Africa. But how is it different? How will American policy develop itself? What are its guiding principles? Have you heard other candidates discuss these? I haven't. I've heard Mr. Nixon speak of having a Navy second to none. I heard him speak yesterday about peace through power, which I translate to be more of the arms race. But I haven't heard him speak on the general themes by which America can assert its legitimate rights, avoid overextending itself, maintain its freedoms without plunging into the morass of another kind of Vietnamese or Korean involvement. And I've heard Mr. Humphrey speak hopefully about the passage of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. And I've heard him speak about the importance of negotiating in Vietnam, but I haven't heard him speak about the future directions of American policy. Will he disengage us from Thailand? What are our long-range commitments to a Philippines, which now has aggressive political ambitions towards some of its island neighbors to the south? How do we respond to another Czechoslovakia? I think the way in which both candidates have handled Israel is a case in point. There is no Zionist issue in this campaign. Both candidates, as you know, have long records of friendliness towards the state of Israel. Both spoke out early, Mr. Nixon first, about the need to give Israel new, more speedy supersonic fighters, so-called phantom jets, in order to compensate for some of the rearming by the Soviet Union of the United Arab Republic. That's all to the good. But this is, in a sense, the ice cream and lollipops I was talking about earlier. This isn't foreign policy. The basic issue is what can America do to make peace in the Middle East? And the basic answer remains what it has been for the last 20 years, to give Israel certain kinds of substantial, predictable support, the same way the Soviet Union gives Egypt this kind of support, so that the Arab world knows that there's never going to be a chance to drive a wedge between the big power, the little democracy. Only in that way will ultimately saner heads prevail in the Arab world. But I haven't heard either candidate say that. But for that matter, none of their predecessors ever said it either. What I'm saying is simply this. Both candidates, these last weeks of the campaign, must speak forcefully, directly, to the issues and show their respect for the wisdom of the American people. You know, maybe 20 years ago, you could have Madison Avenued a candidate into the presidency. But we've watched television sets for the last 20 years. And every kind of publicity ploy has been tried on us. And we're streetwise. And I think that there's a counter-reaction which develops among us when we feel that we're being sold a president the way we're sold soap or detergent. We want a president who can advocate, who is principled, who has convictions. We want a president who can lead where we think this nation can go. Now, we are used long since to the game of politics, and we're used long since to the oratory and the embellishments of a political year. We forgive these. But only if there's a hard core of understandable common sense, a platform, principle, so that we know where a man specifically stands. If he wants to wear an Indian headdress or march in a Freedom Day for Ireland parade, we understand that. But let him be very, very clear on the basic issues, the issues of foreign policy, the issues of race, the issues of poverty and life. I'm glad to see Mr. Humphrey has begun to speak clearly and loudly. He's beginning to emerge as a personality, a man of conviction. I pray that Mr. Nixon may yet do so, so that we can choose between those principles which we feel to be the most necessary, and choose the man in the party with whose principles we agree. But whatever else we do come this November, none of us can look himself in the mirror on the 6th unless he votes in the presidential campaign, unless he votes against evil, Mr. Wallace, in the presidential campaign, and unless he promises himself as he pulls the lever of that machine, this isn't the end of my political duty. My country needs my skills, my energies, and my conviction. I'm one of those great moderate people who love freedom and respect justice and hope for the best. I've learned to make do and to live. I think it's time now that my country heard another voice, not the raucous revolutionary voice of the right, not the ugly racist voice, of the left, not the ugly racist voice of the right, but the voice of deliberate common sense, the voice of determination, courage, a proud voice in the institutions of freedom, a voice which insists on sanity in political debate, which is open to new ideas, but which will never accept the destruction of a political system simply for the childish glee in destroying it. I'm not going to rise, whoever is elected among the major candidates on the 6th of November, and say Kaddish for this great nation. Our resources have not yet been tested. But I must say this to you. The hour grows late. The debate grows more acid, bitter. The forces of ugliness and of violence grow stronger. Some chose to cop out 4 years ago. More will choose to do so this year. And the only therapy I know for the diseases which afflict this nation is a transfusion of human energy, decency, commitment, your energy, your decency, your commitment. Amen.